Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies, discussions with scholars of France and the Francophone world about their new books. I'm your host, Roxane Panchassi. My guest today is Elizabeth Carlscott, author of Defending National Treasures, French Art and Heritage Under Vichy, and the book was published by Stanford University Press in 2011. Hi there, Elizabeth.
Hi.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I wonder if you could get us started by telling us a little bit about yourself and your background and how you became interested in working on France.
Sure. My passion for French history really stemmed from language studies. I grew up in Missoula, Montana, and had a fabulous French teacher in high school, Madame Nancy Bitney. It was the first time that I really learned about all sorts of aspects of French culture. The first time I remember seeing an image of a Monet painting was in my high school French class when she held up a postcard of Monet's water lilies. Mm. I had a chance to go to France for several weeks the summer before my junior year in high school, lived with a French family for 2 weeks in Nevers, and that's when I truly became a Francophile. So when I was looking at going to college, I thought what I wanted to do was go into international relations. I had some vague sense of maybe doing international law or business, whatever that might mean. Mm-hmm. So I went to Georgetown University in the School of Foreign Service. And in my junior year, studied abroad at Sciences Po and studied 20th century French history. And that's when I realized that actually my real interest was in contemporary history. So I felt like I had some catching up to do since I wasn't a history major. So I earned a licence in history at Paris Gat at the Sorbonne and really learned more about what a life of the mind would mean for me. And was fortunate to enter the graduate program at New York University through the Institute of French Studies and the History Department, where I was able to work with a wide range of excellent scholars. Herrick Chapman was my thesis director. He's a perfect model of a teacher and scholar. Mm. I studied with Tony Judd, with Ken Silver in art history, with Susan Rogers in anthropology. Ed Berenson came on board at NYU toward the end of my time there. Mm-hmm. And another great benefit of the program there is that we meet French scholars who teach as visiting professors. And my first semester at NYU, I took a seminar on French cultural policy with Pascal Horry. Mm-hmm. He's remained a key influence for me ever since.
And so what brought you to the subject of the book in particular? You mentioned the Monet, which makes me think, oh, an early interest in the art historical side of things and that material. Do you trace this book back to an earlier interest in art and heritage and cultural policy?
Yeah, when I started graduate school, I was always interested in that intersection between cultural history and political history. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that I wanted to look at some aspect of that realm where those two areas intersect. So it was through the seminar with Pascal Horry that I started to understand that in terms of how 20th century cultural policy developed in France. I took a seminar with Tony Judd on collaboration and resistance during World War II, not just in France, but in Europe generally. But I remember being in that seminar and feeling that the Vichy period was what I really wanted to focus on. Mm-hmm. And then had a semester, I guess it was my third year in the graduate program, where we start getting into the archives and defining our dissertation topics. I had a pivotal meeting with Pascal Horry, was able to meet up with him again in Paris, met with him at Sciences Po, and it was really a life-changing 10-minute conversation. Wow. Because I told him that I was interested in the Vichy period, wanted to do some aspects of cultural affairs. I had read Laurence Bertrand d'Orléac's book, L'Art de la Défaite. I was influenced by Michel Cohn's book as well, so I needed to do something different. And he suggested something interesting could be Les Politiques de Patrimoine under Vichy. It was a time period that hadn't been studied, even though mm-hmm. there'd been an increasing number of studies on patrimonial policy. And the study really took off from there. Once I then was able to get into the archives very soon afterwards, I realized that it was a very interesting policy area where all sorts of policies were implemented that endured. And after more time, I saw this other side of patrimonial policy that it was, preservationist, but also could have a darker side, mm-hmm. particularly related to the Jewish collections under Vichy.
Well, maybe I'll sort of stop you there, Elizabeth, before we get into talking about the sort of unique and fascinating aspects of all of this in the Vichy period specifically that you focus on in the book, which is to just stop and say, okay, these are terms, you just use them a couple of times, this idea of patrimoine or patrimoine national, sort of the national cultural heritage and national treasures, and patrimania is another term that you use. Mm-hmm. You sort of set up these mm-hmm. terms in the introduction, and then this idea of opportunism. So I just wonder if maybe we could start with you defining these terms for us. What do these things mean? What does patrimoine mean in the French context, not just under Vichy, but in general?
Sure. Well, it's the idea, in the same way that a private patrimony is passed from one generation to another through a will, it's the idea that there are cultural treasures that are overseen by the government and that the state becomes the guardian for these cultural treasures, but rather than a private patrimony, it's a collective patrimony or a national patrimony. So that's the direct translation of patrimoine national, with the idea that these treasures need to be preserved and passed to future generations. And so the cultural meaning really can be traced to the French Revolution, in the context of vandalism against royal and religious symbols, with a sense that there actually needed to be a preservation of these symbols. And then we see steps in the development of policy toward heritage during the 19th century, but then really accelerating in the 20th century.
So I guess the big question, which is at the heart of the whole book, but maybe if we could just sort of do it generally, is, how and why did the issue of patrimoine, these issues of art and heritage, become so significant during the Vichy period? What was the culture that mattered under Vichy? What role did art and heritage play in, what we think of historically as this national revolution under Vichy? Why look at this material under Vichy in particular, and why was it so important during this period?
Yeah, it's important for several different reasons. One is that these cultural treasures were greatly threatened during the war. And so there were significant efforts to protect French cultural heritage even before France had entered the war. And I will clarify too that the idea of patrimoine, in recent years, in the last couple decades, has extended to include a vast array of objects, and there's a very wide definition now of all things that could be considered patrimony. Mm-hmm. But the area that I was really focused on is what would be considered more patrimoine artistique. So I'm in the book focus on museum collections, historic buildings, mm-hmm. Palaces, chateaux, churches, and then archaeological objects. So those are the parameters that I set for the book. Mm-hmm. And we see that in the late Third Republic, there was already an effort to protect French cultural heritage. And this was an area where the French administration was very organized. I've seen documents going back to 1936 where the administrators started to plan how many sandbags would be needed to distribute throughout France to protect precious sculpture. Mm-hmm. A plan put into action to remove stained glass windows from churches and cathedrals. So this was all happening in the late 1930s. And then crucially, some of those important figures from the Third Republic administration would continue in the administration under Vichy. But it was really under Jean Zay at the head of the education ministry and Henri Verne at the head of the Musée National who helped to put these policies into motion so that once war was declared, they already had a plan of action and a plan to evacuate works of art from the most important museums in France. So that by the time the Germans entered Paris in the summer of 1940, the Louvre was largely empty of its most important works. They had already been evacuated. So the heritage also became acutely important because it was so threatened.
Right.
And it was also in these early stages, in the late 30s, in 1940, they were thinking in terms of air warfare and the threat that the works would be submitted to if the Luftwaffe sought to diminish French morale by bombing great cultural sites. What if they had dropped a bomb on the Louvre? So that's really what French administrators were preparing for. Then I was going to say, then so once the Vichy regime was in place, then there also were administrators. So more at the top level. So under a new Minister of Education, Jérôme Cacopineau, who took over as Education Minister in February of 1941, the head of fine arts, Louis Hautecoeur. These men were coming to their positions as political traditionalists who had a classicist aesthetic and also could see the great value in protecting French heritage, but doing so within an entirely new political justification that meshed quite well with the National Revolution being promoted by traditionalists in the Vichy regime, in which, you know, these great historic structures would be preserved to represent really the essence of France.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, Elizabeth, because obviously, you know, you're interested in the issue of heritage and patrimoine sort of more broadly throughout French history, that the book is situated in that larger context. But of course, we know that Vichy defined this period, during this period, what it meant to be French, what Frenchness was, what was valuable versus what was decadent, about aspects of French culture, about aspects that of culture that had taken hold in France if they weren't seen as legitimately French, that these were all major issues throughout the Vichy period. And I'm just wondering, you know, how in the work that you've done, what do we see about how culture is redefined and what's worth protecting? What are the parameters of the patrimoine that is worth preserving during the Vichy period?
Mm-hmm. So there are a few different areas where this comes into play. Louis Hautecoeur in particular was a specialist of French architecture and particularly on the classicist style. And so he saw the golden age of French architecture in the 17th century. And so he was hoping to see a kind of modernism develop in France that would respect more traditional rules in classicism. So these would be, he would favor works of art that would show moderation and that would avoid excesses that you would see in cubist works or expressionist works. So he was promoting a neoclassicism. One way to think about it, there was an important restriction on art exports that was implemented in June of 1941. And it restricted the export of paintings created before 1900, which indicates a priority for those older works. And that would exclude then later productions in the modernist period, shifting more toward cubism and abstraction, expressionism. So I think that that law is one signal. Mm-hmm. And there's also another case, if you look at bronze statues that were dismantled during the occupation period and recycled, this was satisfying a German demand to get bronze materials from France so that they could be shipped to Germany and then recycled into bullets and other armaments, weaponry. But it was the French leadership that decided which statues mm-hmm. would be destroyed. And so that provides some interesting ways to look at how these administrators were analyzing which statues were valuable and which ones were not. And so we see there's a combination of wanting to preserve certain political figures, maybe the French kings, Napoleon, were preserved, but also more abstract works. They also had a disdain for much of the 19th century statuary that had developed, that was considered a lower quality style. Mm-hmm. And so those were works that were selected for recycling, and even of some what you might think of as monarchical or right-wing symbols. Mm-hmm. Whereas I examine a case study of a Rousseau statue in Chambéry that was preserved because it respected what Hautecoeur and others would have seen as displaying more taste and mm-hmm. moderation.
Mm-hmm. So in some ways, Elizabeth, you know, this story of art, heritage, patrimoine, you know, not just in the French context, that this is sort of an international story during the war, you know, the threat to museums and art collections and monuments, the threat from either aerial bombardment or invasion or looting, or that this is a story that isn't unique to France, but you are focused on the national context. I mean, you talk about, obviously, and we'll get to this in a little bit, the relationship between the French and the Germans in this period and how they kind of negotiate expectations and demands and the desire to preserve French national treasures. But you're focused on the national context, and in some cases, you're even looking at more local contexts. And I'm just wondering if you could say a little bit about, you know, methodologically, but also in terms of the arguments that you're trying to make and how you make them, you know, how you negotiate that what's national about this story, I guess, what's unique to France about the preservation of art and museums, collections, monuments, these sorts of things in this period. How do you move between looking at the national story, looking at connections internationally, thinking about the way this all takes shape in local contexts within France? Like how did you negotiate that as you were writing the book, researching the book and writing the book?
Yeah, I do look at it in terms of, specifically the French policies. And, for example, with the evacuation of works of art, I mean, no other country, evacuated their works of art mm-hmm. so effectively. The Soviets, belatedly began, evacuating the works after the German invasion. We're able to get, thousands of works, evacuated to Siberia from the Hermitage. Mm-hmm. But the French really did this better than anyone else. And part of what I was interested in was as the central government was asserting more control over patrimonial policy, also the reaction from municipal and departmental authorities, because in some cases they didn't see it only as a positive move forward that the central government was taking more control. And so in the case of the evacuations, there were examples of some cities not wanting to follow the central administration's instructions to evacuate the works of art. The Musée National ended up managing the evacuation of provincial museums as well. And some resisted at first, but then most realized that it was in their interest to follow the instructions from the central state. This also comes up when I look at archaeological reform, which was implemented in September of 1941. I found this to be a fascinating area because there were regional and local learned societies, so the Société Savante, that had controlled archaeological excavation in their areas. And those learned societies, the amateurs, archaeologists, saw themselves as serving a very important role in investigating the history of their particular local history or regional history. And that archaeological reform law, which gave the state authority to approve requests to excavate, this law had been proposed before in the Third Republic, but these learned societies had a fairly strong lobbying voice in blocking a centralized national policy. And so I was interested in looking at those debates. But under the Vichy regime, they had less access to the political process. Of course, Parliament didn't exist under the Vichy regime. Mm-hmm. And there was a greater awareness that this more centralized policy was necessary. But I did want to investigate some tensions as the centralized policy was being developed, ways in which some folks in some cities outside of Paris were opposing that mm-hmm. centralized policy.
Mm-hmm. So there's this interesting movement between that and the book, between these different contexts and these different actors in different areas of France, you know, referring back to the center that you were just talking about. In the introduction to the book, Elizabeth, you suggest that, and you do this throughout in various ways throughout the chapters, you suggest that the realm of art and heritage, you know, contributes to our understanding with more complexity the big issues of collaboration and resistance in the Vichy mm-hmm. period. And mm-hmm. I just wonder if you could say, sort of in a general sense, how you see the book as a contribution to that broader historiography of France during this period. What does the world of art tell us about the world outside of art and heritage, and how these things are connected in this period?
Sure. Well, the Musée Nationaux, since the Vichy regime, has been considered really a bastion of resistance in the Vichy administration. The head of Musée Nationaux, Jacques Chagall, was honored with a resistance medal after the war, and played an important role in supporting the resistance effort in some ways. For example, he allowed members of the resistance to use his apartment at the Louvre. There are some key examples where Jaujard led the National Museum curators in opposing German demands. One of these is when Pierre Laval was willing to give up the famous Ghent altarpiece, which the French had been protecting for the Belgian government. And it was Pierre Laval who was willing to give up the Ghent altarpiece to the Germans, thinking that it would increase his leverage with Hitler. Of course it didn't. And the entire arts administration was outraged by that move. And so Jacques Chagall led the National Museum curators in protesting against that important example of cultural collaboration. So that took tremendous courage mm-hmm. to stand up to Laval and to voice his opposition. What I want to do in the book is show those examples of resistance, but then also complicate notions of resistance. Because mm-hmm. one area that I delved into that I didn't expect to, but I found that I really needed to, the more research I did in this period, the more I saw that the way the Vichy regime handled art looted from Jewish collections in France had to be a part of this story. Mm-hmm. And so part of what I investigated was how the National Museum Administration approached works of art from Jewish collections that the French government was able to sequester mm-hmm. That had eluded the Nazis. There were some important collections that were found in the unoccupied zone that were protected by the French Museum Administration under Vichy. So part of what I found, the more that I was looking into the fate of these sequestered collections, was that there was an effort by the museum administration under Vichy, not just to protect those works of art, but actually to incorporate them into the national collections.
So this is the opportunism that you talk about in the book.
Yes, yes. And this came because there was a law that was enacted in October of 1940 that Jews who emigrated lost their citizenship status. And once they lost that citizenship status, then the state also had a right to seize their assets. And according to Vichy law, normally those assets would be put up for public auction with the proceeds benefiting the French treasury. So in the case of the sequestered art collections, these were absolute masterpieces. If we take the example of the Robert de Rothschild collection, so Robert fled to the United States, and part of his collection was seized in the unoccupied zone. It had paintings by Rembrandt, Fragonard, Picasso, Renoir, Degas, and these were masterpieces. And the museum administration, and this again is, this is Jojao, so recipient of the Resistance Medal, and also René Wieg, who was director of paintings at the Louvre, and who would join the FFI, the resistance forces in southern France as part of the resistance. These men pursued a strategy to acquire these works of art for the National Museum collections. And the idea was that at that point, because of Vichy law, these works of art really had no owner. And so the choice was to let them go to auction, or the French government could try somehow to intervene to incorporate those works of art into national collections. So they ended up securing, through an extensive process, but they ended up securing about 66 million francs, which was a tremendous increase in the acquisition budget for the Musée National, to incorporate the best of those sequestered collections for national museums. So I wanted to show that this was not just about protecting works of art, but it was about taking works from Jewish collections and keeping them for the Louvre and other museums.
Do you think, Elizabeth, that how do I say this, that should we see this as, I mean, as you point out, as this kind of opportunism on the part of museum administrators and, you know, the people involved in acquisitions to take advantage of a situation in which French Jews were, you know, losing, well, not just their citizenship, but, you know, their private possessions, including their art collections, as they fled. But if we connect it to the history, I mean, I guess I'm wondering, how do we connect this to the history of French anti-Semitism, the history not just of Jews who left the country, but those who were deported? Like, what's the connection between the history you tell in this book and that, well, certainly most painful part of the history of the Vichy period?
Mm-hmm. I think it has to be understood in the broader history of the Holocaust. And it has to be emphasized that these are collections of people who had emigrated. And so the Rothschild family, we're talking about people who had tremendous resources. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, clearly these were not the most tragic victims of the Holocaust, but I think it must be understood within the broader system that was created by the Vichy regime to seize Jewish assets. Mm-hmm. The language that's used by Jojard and particularly René Wieg in looking at these art collections, it's really stunning how quickly it was seen as a tremendous opportunity. René Wieg has very clear language in his letters saying that, for example, Rembrandt's landscapes from the Robert de Rothschild collection would fill a gap in the Louvre. And he writes quite extensively about how the Louvre must maintain a gross mission as a public museum. And the bigger context is that the Louvre was competing with private museums. The MoMA had been established in the United States. They were competing with private buyers who could afford to buy works of art that were coming up on the art market in a way that the French state could not. And so I think it has to be seen in that bigger context of Jewish assets being seized. And the way that the incorporation of those works of art is justified. There's another example of the Schloss family collection, and that is a whole different category because the members of the Schloss family did not emigrate. This was a case of outright theft that was carried out through a combination of, very shady French characters, a shady French art dealer, Lefranc, who worked with the Germans to locate this hidden collection, but the owners hadn't emigrated. They were still in France. It's outright theft. Mm-hmm. And the French administration negotiated with the Germans to secure 49 paintings. They got a right of first refusal to choose 49 paintings first from this collection of 333. Hitler was dissatisfied with this arrangement that Goering had first agreed to, but the French kept 49. And again, we get very enthusiastic language from Wieg. I mean, there's no, for the Louvre, this is a tremendous opportunity to acquire works from this collection. And for me, the significance also comes in to look at what the Musée National did next in the post-war period, which maybe you want to come back to.
Yeah, I think we will come back to that.
Okay.
I mean, I think I just want to, well, there's a couple of questions I have now. I mean, we've sort of covered the fact that, you know, the war was actually, you know, one might think that the war would be a terrible moment to focus on these kinds of issues. But in fact, you know, as you've shown in the book, and as you were talking about a little bit earlier, that it provides this kind of opportunity because this imminent threat actually creates an opportunity for cultural reform in certain ways. And then you talked about the evacuation of public collections, something that is really distinctive in the French case, just in terms of the ways that the French were able to mobilize along these lines and the administrative reorganization of museums and sites and monuments, all these things. And you've also talked about the way that kind of Vichy policy and preservation, how that's continuous in some ways, and also a break with the policies of the Third Republic before 1940. And in the second half of the book, and we've already sort of, you know, dipped into this a bit as we've been talking, is much more focused on that, the Franco-German conflict, and the ways in which some of the examples that you're using, that there were this negotiation and accommodation. And you do show the ways that this story of art and heritage connects with the bigger issues of collaboration and resistance, which is issue of accommodation and opportunism. And I'm just wondering, you know, when you step back from the story, how you see the complexities of the moral history here, and whether or not we should see the French administrators, people in charge of museums who were negotiating all this, should we see their accommodation as, you know, the best they could do under the circumstances, or should we see it as again, another instance of opportunism? Should we see it as outright collaboration? Like how do you come away from this history thinking about some of those, perhaps more moral historical questions, ethical historical questions about the role of the French in the Second World War in relationship to the Nazi state, really, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I take it on a case by case basis. I think it's very difficult to generalize. Laval, I think that the example of the Ghent altarpiece shows how he was willing to collaborate with the Nazis in all sorts of ways. And certainly the Ghent altarpiece is not the most tragic, but I think it needs to be understood as part of the collaboration that was also part of his approach that led to French participation in the final solution. And in the case of Abel Bonnard, who succeeded Jérôme Carcopino, we also see a greater enthusiasm for collaboration with the Germans. Although I do, in the book, I do nuance. I want to take all these figures and nuance sort of commonly held visions of their approach. Bonnard had been blamed for giving up the Ghent altarpiece, for example, in this key example of cultural collaboration when you know, more study. And I went back to documents on this issue. And it, I mean, it really is Laval who was responsible for that act. But Bonnat was, of course, enthusiastic about collaboration with the Germans. And then, you know, I take the case of someone like Louis Hauteville, so head of fine arts until just before the end of the occupation. I see him as someone who was very intent to implement the more preservationist measures that we were talking about, and was very hesitant and careful in how he approached dealings with the Germans, so that he was not the one to oppose, for example, giving up the Gantalter Peace. He wasn't going to step out to resist to that extent. He was much more attentiste and let Zhou Zhao play the role as the leader who would oppose collaboration in that sense. But then I've worked hard to understand the scope of actions from these other folks like Wieg and Zhou Zhao. And I've worked hard to understand their mindset. Mm. So to understand, you know, if these great collections are just going to be sold at auction, how that would diminish the heritage, which, and one thing that I find so interesting is how quickly public and private blurred. Mm. And so that those private collections were considered part of the national heritage. And so I have worked to understand their position. If they didn't try to act, they could be put up for auction and, you know, scattered, you know, lost, from France forever. And so you can make an argument that they kept those pieces on French territory, mm-hmm. and were able to give those collections back to the owners after the war. But I also have been very interested in how quickly it became a fantastic opportunity for the Musée National.
Right.
And you know, from a wide range of actors, in order to purchase works of art. So what they were doing is carrying out a right of first refusal that the Musée National had enjoyed since the 1920s. That would prevent those works of art from going to auction. And in doing so, they had to get a lot of approval. So there's a museum committee that had to approve acquisitions. I saw Ministry of Finance documents. So a whole range of people had to approve these purchases because they were pursued as true acquisitions. And I was struck by the breadth of support, of enthusiastic support for acquiring those works of art, mm-hmm. That to me fit uncomfortably in the bigger picture of what was going on in the broader seizure of Jewish assets within the context of the final solution.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk, Elizabeth, about what happens after the war, both in terms of the continuities and, you know, changes with respect to Vichy cultural policy around art and heritage, but also, you know, what you've just brought up. You said something about being able to give works back, and, you know, so if the book in its focus on the Vichy period contributes to our understanding of the complexities of collaboration and resistance, how does the post-war period, so what happens in the post-war period with respect to cultural policy, but also how does the post-war period, how does what happens with art and restitution and, you know, the longer term policy effects and all these things, how does it relate to the post-war history of coming to terms with the past, you know, denying collaboration, the Vichy syndrome, like does the story of art fit into that historiography and set of issues as well?
Yes, absolutely. So one reason why I think that example of the sequestered collections during the wartime period, even though they were returned to the rightful owners, there was no disputing whom those works of art belonged to. These were very famous collections. Mm. So they were returned to the owners, although not immediately. an interesting aspect of this study is that many of these folks wrote memoirs, and like Germaine Bazin, who's a key National Museum curator, writes about the restitution and that just after the liberation, the sequestered works were given back. And there has been a consistent narrative since Vichy in saying that those works were sequestered. Even Rose Vallon, who also was a recipient of the Resistance Medal, who you know, we can perhaps talk about her separately, but even she had described this as a way to keep these works of art away from the Nazis. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't tell the whole picture. Mm-hmm. And the works of art were not returned right away. In the case of the Schloss collection, René Wieg was still determined to try to get some of those works of art into the Louvre. Mm. And they first proposed that out of gratitude to the French administration for helping to preserve their works of art, those 49 that they kept, that maybe the Schloss family would donate some works to the Louvre. And so I've looked at the documents with the Schloss family attorneys communicating with the Louvre. Mm-hmm. And they say, we have considered your proposal, but we reject it. We want the works of art back. Then the Louvre says, well, perhaps we could purchase some of these works from you. The attorney writes back and says, no, the owners want their works of art back. And so they were still trying to strategize. Mm-hmm. In the end, the Schloss family did end up, you know, over the next few decades, donating some works to the Louvre. But in the post-war period, you see an initial reluctance. Mm-hmm. It's not as clear as just giving them back right away. And I also think that this is very important in looking at the continuity of what happened with other so-called ownerless works of art in the post-war period. Mm. With the recovery of works of art, so there were around 60,000 objects that went to France. There were about 16,000 that had not been claimed by 1949. And so the restitution process, again, was relatively straightforward for the largest collectors, members of the Rothschild family. They had insurance policies, photographs, extensive documentation. These collections were well known by the curators. There was no question whom the works of art belonged to. But beyond those large collectors, then the process became much more complicated. And so by 1949, 16,000 had not been claimed. So again, the French government was in a position where it was controlling works, some that were masterpieces, Matisse, Picasso, Braque, where the state had an opportunity to hold on to some of those works. So over the next few years, they auctioned off about 14,000 and kept what they considered the 2,000 most valuable works that could be placed under a state guardianship. Now, part of the problem with this approach, although it was standard for the time, and this is also what happened in the Netherlands and Belgium, for example, they also had 900 boxes of archives related to the looting process. They had seized some documents in Germany and also some documents in France. They had 900 boxes of documents. To this day, there has not been a systematic review of those documents to try to trace those 2,000 works of art. Most of them are still under state guardianship, to use the archives to trace them to potential heirs. Mm. Part of the problem was that there has always been the burden of proof placed on claimants, which again, it follows the international norms of the time. So claimants are expected to provide compelling, irrefutable documentation of ownership. Mm-hmm. Well, we're talking about family. So if you look at the smaller collectors, maybe just a handful of objects or one object, but that could have some value. These were families that lost everything and their homes were entirely emptied. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, children of Holocaust victims would have no documentation.
Right.
And even to this day, there is now just a process that it looks to be developing to do a more systematic review of those archives. Mm-hmm. But it's been very slow in coming.
Are there other significant, just in terms of the continuity into the post-war period and what some of the issues are after the war is over? I mean, maybe we don't have time to get into all of them, but are there one or two kind of things that stand out in terms of what remains into the post-war period of the types of policies and preservationist moves that were made under Vichy?
Yes, so those preservationist reforms, the major ones endured. And that was what I initially thought the study would focus on. Hmm. So the museum law from August of 1941, really reorganizing fine arts museums, extending state control over provincial museums in particular. That's probably the most significant part of the law. That was validated in 1945. The archaeology reform law has endured. It's still known as the Carcopino law, going back to the ministry of Jerome Carcopino. So that endured, although there has been, you know, since the 1980s with decentralization efforts to give regional powers more control, but that essential law endured. The export restriction law from 1941 endured until 1995 when it was modified along with European Union law, and then other like laws protecting historic sites endured also. These were measures that the post-war government, the provisional government, then validated because they were seen as important measures that should be maintained.
Mm-hmm. You just said something about the French state in your comments just a few moments ago, and I just wanted to ask you about this because I think it's really fascinating. You, at some point, you know, you offer the book as a contribution, you know, not just to our understanding of art and heritage, but to this much bigger set of issues and questions about French state and administration. Mm-hmm. And I would love to hear you say a little bit more about what you mean by this and how you see the book as an intervention in that, you know, bigger set of issues about the state in relationship to culture and the state in relationship to its citizen. I know that's a huge question, but I would like to hear what you have to say about that.
Sure. I am interested in, of course, how the Vichy regime creates breaks. It fits very well into that common duality that's described about breaks and continuities with the Vichy regime. But I do see this broader continuity that runs from proposals for these preservationist measures in the late Third Republic, implemented under the Vichy regime and then validated in the post-war government, so that it is a study of the broader state that transcends these individual regimes. And part of what I wanted to show is why they were finally implemented under the Vichy regime. Mm-hmm. A large factor was the fact that there was no parliament, and so these could be enacted by executive decree with really activist administrators. But also understanding how it fit into the broader objectives of the cultural administration, stretching from before the Vichy regime and extending afterwards.
Well, Elizabeth, the book came out in 2011. And, you know, one of the reasons I was excited to interview you about it in 2014 is this film, right?
Yes.
The Monuments Men, which I've seen, and I know you've seen.
Yes.
And, you know, not just the film, the Clooney film, but the what seems to me, I don't know if it's because of the film or if the film is because of this, but, you know, in recent years, and especially in the last 6 months or so, I feel like every time I look at the news,
yes,
there's some story about some mm-hmm. stolen art. I just read this article like a couple of days ago about this amazing work of art that happened to be hanging in some Italian older mm-hmm. man's house. Mm-hmm. Like this yes. sort of, I feel like this discovering art, finding lost art, you know, restoring stolen art to its owners, that this is such a kind of recurring motif in popular culture and the news of late. and perhaps over the last several years. So I guess I want to ask you, have to ask you about the film, your thoughts yes. on the film and how it represents the kind of, you know, the history that you do with this intense, you know, scholarly focus and research in the book, in a much more popular way. And, you know, what you think about the significance of why are we so focused on mm-hmm. the question of stolen or lost art right now? What is it about this moment? Is it just about the passage of time, or is there something else going on? And yeah, just whatever you have to say about those different things.
Sure. Well, I think that there were some important scholars and writers who laid the foundation for all this intense interest that we're seeing now. Hector Feliciano, in 1995, wrote The Musée Disparu, or The Lost Museum, published in 1997. He really was the first writer, he was a journalist, to investigate those 2,000 works of art that are still under French guardianship. Mm-hmm. And from a very critical perspective, he used U.S. National Archives to trace paintings to likely heirs. Mm. And he did it in a way to show the French government that they could do the same thing. It was a very courageous book. And it came out about the same time that Lynn Nicholas wrote The Rape of Europa, mm-hmm. which did reach an educated audience. Mm-hmm. Jonathan Petropoulos' work on Nazi art looting was also coming out at the same time, the late 90s. Mm-hmm. So that was a time when the Musée de France was forced to confront its policy toward those unclaimed works. Mm-hmm. We also saw the publication of what's called the Mattioli Commission report mm-hmm. in 2000. And so it was also a time when states were investigating their role in the seizure of Jewish assets and what mm-hmm. ought to be done today. Mm-hmm. Included a volume on the fine arts, which I argue in my book is not nearly critical enough of mm-hmm. the Musée de France's approach. But it signals a bigger effort to recognize ways in which these countries contributed to the seizure of Jewish assets and still were continuing to benefit from them. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that foundation had been laid. There were several significant landmark cases just in the last decade. Maria Altman receiving Klimt paintings from the Austrian government. Mm-hmm. And it's partly that these works of art garner such huge sums of money on the art market. Mm-hmm. And so then she was able to auction off, you know, which she sold one to Ronald Lauder for the Neue Gallery in New York, but then others were auctioned off for millions of dollars. There was also the Uitsticker heir in the United States who received 200 paintings from the Dutch government mm-hmm. in the last several years. So there are these key restitutions that gained a lot of attention, partly because of the high value of these works of art. And I also think that there's been a greater public education, looking into learning about the Holocaust, so that the discussion of art then does not seem merely frivolous mm-hmm. And can be seen as a way for heirs to achieve belated justice. Mm. So another important contributor to all of this, it has to be said, for popular audiences is Robert Edsel, who wrote The Monuments Men, mm-hmm. on which the film is based. Edsel is a retired oil entrepreneur. That's where he made his fortune. He was able to self-finance his first book, Rescuing Da Vinci, and has done noble work in making the history of the art experts who became officers and recovered these works of art from Nazi caches. Mm-hmm. He's done some very noble work in making that history known. And so George Clooney and his writing partner, Grant Heslov, had discovered Edsel's book. Mm-hmm. Heslov found it in an airport bookshop. Hmm. And they were inspired by the story and thought that it would make a great Hollywood film. So Edsel's book serves as a foundation for the film. Mm-hmm. And I do think that it has a positive benefit for the public. I mean,
This is a hard question to answer, isn't it?
Well, let's recognize what's good about it.
Yeah.
It does make the history much more widely known. All yes. of my friends, my friends who have no connection to academe, always ask about the film and say that they had no idea about this history. They really didn't even know much about Nazi art looting. It is making this history sure. more widely known. The problem is that despite the very noble work that Robert Edsel is doing, there are significant gaps in the book that then get exaggerated at least tenfold in the film. Mm-hmm. For example, Edsel is really interested in focusing on American heroes, and his foundation, the Monuments Men Foundation, pays homage to these men. They always add and women, although the women tend to get left out of the basic phrasing of the Monuments Men. But he's very interested in honoring these heroes. Mm-hmm. And there is truth to that. If you look at their diaries and their reports and how dangerous the work was, rescuing these works of art from salt mines under harrowing conditions, mm-hmm. There is true heroism there that, mm-hmm. that should be recognized and honored. But there is also a great deal that gets left out, mm-hmm. Both in Edsel's book and the film.
Mm-hmm. And so you've been asked, I guess as a scholar, I'm sort of curious about this, you've been asked to comment on the film. I mean, I'm asking you to comment on the film,
yeah.
but you've also been asked, to participate in sort of documentary work, responding to the film and responding to this history. And I'm just wondering, as a scholar, I'm sure that there are parts of that are exciting and wonderful, but it must be a challenge as well to kind of know the history in the complexity that you know it and have worked on it, and then to have to kind of respond in that those kind of media venues. And I'm just wondering how that's been for you to have the subject of your book, which is about a lot of other things as well as things that are connected to this history, how you've negotiated that as a scholar. Just curious about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been able to get some pieces out in the press. I actually tried much harder. I wanted to get my critique out there even more than it has been. I really felt it was important to point out weaknesses in the film, and I wanted to do so not playing the role of the accuracy police. Mm-hmm. I think that can make scholars look petty. If we focus too much on the more minute details, I think it can tend to keep us in the ivory tower, yeah. and then we're recruited to serve this role. Or how accurate is this film? And I really wanted to focus on the bigger picture. And mm-hmm. so, for example, one thing that I thought absolutely had to be stated was that the Holocaust is left out. It's largely left out of the film. Mm-hmm. And I do think that it's a weakness in Edsel's book and in his focus on these mostly American heroes. We're not getting a bigger picture of the seizure of Jewish assets and how art fit into the final solution. Mm-hmm. I think it has to be understood in that context. And so I wanted to make that point. I also was very dismayed by the interpretation of Rose Vallon's activities. So the character played by Kate Blanchett, who the name in the film is Claire Simon. So Clooney and Heslop, who wrote the screenplay, invented fictional names for mm-hmm. all of the characters, but it's very clear whom they're referring to. Mm-hmm. And I was very dismayed by the interpretation of Rose Vallon. They do a good job of showing how Rose Vallon opposed the looting that was being carried out by the Germans, her resentment, her anger toward Göring, and the figure in the film who really is like Hermann Bunyez, who's one of the dealers working for Göring, mm-hmm. Art historians. It accurately shows her resentment toward their looting activities. But then the film takes this very unfortunate turn where she propositions Matt Damon's character, who
remains true.
Yes, he's a clear representation of James Rorimer. There was a really crucial partnership between Rorimer, who would later go on to be the director of the Met, and Valmont. That was a very important partnership that becomes devalued in the film, because then toward the end, it seems that they needed a romance in the film. Mm-hmm. And so she propositions him, and he's the good, upstanding, married American man who declines her advances. And in the end, the film really dishonors the work and legacy of Valmont, which I found disappointing. Mm-hmm. So I thought that those bigger points needed to be made. And so I did work pretty hard to get my opinion out there. I exceeded in a couple ways. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I'll just have to remain happy with that.
Well, and it's exciting, I guess, too, right, to have the subject that you deal with in your work, you know, that George Clooney cares. Or that there is this kind of broader audience for the material that we're working on. I think that I can see there's an exciting aspect to that. Well, Elizabeth, I've taken up a lot of your time, so I just have one last question, which is, what are you working on now?
So I'm continuing the story from Defending National Treasures. I'm now looking at the post-war period and the recovery of works of art from those Nazi caches. And it's really the work of the Monuments Men, or the MFAA section. I prefer to say Monuments Men and women to emphasize the important role played by women in this history as well. So I am going to look further into the situation of those unclaimed works of art that were under a guardianship in France. It will also be a comparative study, because there were very similar practices in the Netherlands and in Belgium. Mm. So I'm going to be comparing the guardianships that were created in all three countries and look at the different ways that they were justifying the protection of those unclaimed works of art, and also understanding the international legal norms with regard to unclaimed works of art, and understanding these transnational processes, since the recovery efforts can't be limited to just a national phenomenon, and also the working of the art market also was international, and so it will be a comparative study focusing on the post-war period.
Well, it sounds like an exciting project, and I hope I'll get a chance to talk to you about it sometime in the near future. Elizabeth, I just want to thank you so much for joining me today and for writing the book.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure to talk with you.
You've been listening to New Books in French Studies. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I hope you'll join us again next time.